Good morning, everyone. Hearty souls are you. Thank you for coming. I am going to have our TMR member and a former board member of the Jocelyn Gage Foundation introduce our speaker this morning, Ellen Schwartz.
How are you this lovely day? You're here, and I'd like to welcome you to the very first presentation during Women's History Month. And I'd like to let you know that, amazingly enough, Women's History Month has only existed since 1987, which is only 30 years ago. So it's something to remember. Jimmy Carter started proclaimed Women's History Week in 1980, and it was always around the week of International Women's Day on March 8th. So I am looking forward to the time when women are just part of history every day. So we're going to look at that all year round. But today we're really lucky because we have a wonderful woman who's been part of the women's history movement, the women's movement in general, for years, awarded one of the first doctorates in the country for work in women's studies at UC Santa Cruz, and a founder of the first college-level women's studies program in the U.S., Dr. Sally Roche Wagner currently serves as an adjunct faculty member in the Renee Crown University Honors Program at Syracuse University and the St. John Fisher Executive Leadership Program. She's the author of numerous women's history books and articles telling the untold stories. Her recent publications center on the Haudenosaunee influence on the women's rights movement. She wrote the faculty guide for Not For Ourselves Alone, Ken Burns' documentary on Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and appeared in that film and other PBS women's history programs. Dr. Wagner was selected as one of 21 leaders for the 21st century by Women's E-News in 2015. She's the founder and executive director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Center for Social Justice Dialogue in Fayetteville and author of articles on historic house museums. And she received the Catherine Coffey Award for Outstanding Service to Museology from the Mid-Atlantic Association of Museums in 2012. I want you to know that I moved here about 20 years ago to work at Onondaga Historical Association, and that's when I was lucky enough to meet Sally. She was doing research in the OHA archives to really bring to light the history of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who, like many women, has been hidden away in archives and libraries and museums across the country. And Matilda is one of those amazing women as well that was part of the triumvirate with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and so many others who worked for the right of women to vote and so many other rights that we have been fighting for. And I will say that we're going to be celebrating 100 years of women's winning the right to vote, not being given the right to vote. And Sally continues the tradition of writing women back into history. So I'd like to welcome Sally Roche Wagner.
And it's wonderful to see hearty souls this morning. You know, one of my biggest, sorrows is that I don't get to hang out more in the OHA archives. It's, to be a research junkie and to be taken off your habit is not an easy thing. But now I get to share with you, and I'm really honored to be here today to kick off Women's History Month, and thank you so much, Eileen, for inviting me. What if I told you there's a feminist in our community who is one of the nationally recognized leaders of the women's rights movement, author of some of the most important documents, editor of a feminist newspaper? She exposed sex trafficking and sexual abuse by priests long before anyone was talking about it. Reproductive rights, equal pay, violence against women, you name it, she's an advocate. a supporter of treaty rights and native sovereignty, documenting the authority of indigenous women, she is given an honorary adoption into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation, along with a real name. She declared that there will never be peace in our nation until there is absolute equality among every group, men and women, native-born and immigrant, black and white, rich and poor. And on top of it, she is the inspiration behind the most important young adult book series in her generation. May I introduce you to Matilda Jocelyn Gage of Fayetteville, New York, who 150 years ago did all of this. This is why Gloria Steinem has named her the woman who was ahead of the women who were ahead of their time. This is an important time for Matilda. All the women's rights and human rights hard won are under siege, and her message speaks to us today. There's another reason. The U.S. government was founded on a vision of rule by the people, not a monarch or a ruling elite, but each person with a voice, a vote. But 144 years later, half the people still were not recognized in the Constitution as having a voice. State by state, women carved out a voice, winning the vote in school, municipal, finally state government. New York, as Ellen told us, in 1917. But federally, women were still silenced. The 19th Amendment was finally ratified in 1920, guaranteeing women the right to vote. It has rightly been called the Second American Revolution. Gage said, up until that point, and she didn't live to see that time, but during her time, she said, we don't live under a republic. This is not a democracy. This is an oligarchy of sex. Men rule women. The Second American Revolution established a full democracy. The first established a government by and for rich white men. The Woman's Suffrage Amendment signaled the completion of the revolution begun in 1776. Now, this is a moment of great potential, a celebration of significance, and there's a great potential to create a major national celebration in 2020, comparable to the blockbuster 1976 bicentennial. You remember that? When the nation focused a year celebrating the first American Revolution, the centennial of the second one could be as big. But the greatest likelihood from all the signs is that it will be a huge ho-hum, a lost opportunity. Why? Part of it is the story we have to tell. The dominant narrative is this. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton led women in asking for the vote for 72 years and were finally given it. My students at SU tell me this is exactly what they're learning in history classes still today. Frankly, this story stinks like old cheese. It has no guts, no passion, no relevance. It's disempowering. Does a young girl see herself in it anywhere? It's yesterday's news. And how is it used? Women are shamed into voting. You have a responsibility to vote because your foremothers worked so hard for you to have this right. This is just a collective version of the old, I work my fingers to the bone for you. And it's not even the real story. Sit in a yearly National Women's Rights Convention in the 1850s and hear demands for equal pay and an end to violence against women. Attend a National Women's Suffrage Association convention in the 1870s to fight for a woman's right to control her own body and make her reproductive choices. Read Matilda Jocelyn Gage's book, Woman, Church, and State. published in 1893, and learn about the sexual abuse of children by priests and the terrible problem of sex trafficking. 1893. Watch the merger of the suffrage groups in 1890 and see this multi-issue grassroots movement collapse into an authoritarian, single-minded focus on the vote, systematically tossing all the other issues of women's oppression aside like so much baggage. In the 1850s conventions, you will sit beside blacks and whites, free lovers and social conservatives, atheists and Christians. But by 1900, you may belong to a segregated state affiliate of the National American Merged Women's Suffrage Association, making the argument to men that they should give women the right to vote because women, white women, outnumber blacks and immigrants, and woman's suffrage is a way to maintain white, native-born supremacy. Or you may be a member of a black woman's suffrage association. Given the segregation, women, African-American women, organized on their own. You may listen to your minister preach an anti-suffrage sermon, citing biblical passages proving that God decreed that women should be under the authority of men, and women voting will destroy the family and ultimately Western civilization. A common sermon. Or you may be a free thought member opposing women's suffrage because you fear the agenda of the largest women's organization, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. They're working to get the vote so they can put God in the Constitution, Jesus Christ as the head of the government, and destroy the wall of separation between church and state and create a fundamentalist religious government. You may find your model of how women should be treated in your nearby neighbors, the Haudenosaunee, the six Native nations where women have an equal voice in government, body right, spiritual agency, an authority the opposite of your life. This story has agency, conflict, relevance, passion. It's sexy. It makes us wonder, if we didn't know this, what else don't we know about history? It creates a hunger for more history, more truth in history. It invites us to engage in heated argument, or better yet, dialogue about our issues today. It makes a space for us to fit our story next to that of our foremothers and our forefathers. But it's a story that probably won't be told over the next 3 years. Why? Because women are marginalized. In 2012, the New York State Legislature budgeted $450,000 for events commemorating the War of 1812. $450,000. In 2016, the New York State Legislature budgeted $500,000 for events commemorating the entry of one half the population into political life. That is the best they could come up with in their $90 billion budget. We, the women of New York State, half the population, are as important as one single men's war. There's a word for this, the Matilda effect. Seriously, Robert K. Merton in 1968 came up with the title Matthew effect, based on Matthew 13:12 in the Bible, to describe science's non-merit-based hierarchy. Why do prizes go to those whose names are known and not necessarily the ones who create the breakthrough? Them what has, gets. Then along came Margaret Rossiter, a Cornell scientist who said, well, the opposite is also true. The women who create the breakthroughs are not recognized. Second part of Matthew. Them what don't have, don't get. She named the phenomenon the Matilda effect after, guess who? Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who both made breakthroughs and then got written out of history. Them what don't have, don't get. The European Union picked this up, naming their masters in women's history the Matilda program after the Matilda effect. And France has now named their gender equity curriculum Matilda after guess who? So our very own Matilda is now a household word in Europe. Let's bring that recognition home. Because of the Matilda effect, women are eternally grateful for crumbs. Despite our marginalized funding, over and over, we get things done. We do it if it needs to be done, and we do it on a shoestring. We are the bake sale queens. Let's reverse our thinking. Let's think big. Let's think what we could do with 12,548,710.60. That's the cost of one drone. A single MQ-9 Reaper unnamed aircraft. The Air Force ordered 10 of them. Let's tell them to get by with 9. Or none. What could we do with $12.5 million? I love New York signs. 514 of them were put up along 90, promoting agriculture and tourism. It turns out the signs violate federal highway rules, which no one apparently bothered to check before they spent $8.1 million on them. The Federal Highway Administration threatened to cut $1 billion in transportation funding if the signs aren't taken down. It will cost another chunk of money to take them down. We know what Nicholas Kristof found when he studied international funding. Give the money to men, and they spend it on hookers and booze. Give it to women, and they spend it on education, health, and building the community. Upstate needs economic development. We're all agreed on that, right? And the state government threw money at it. You know what they got when New York State gave money to men to develop upstate's economy? Felony charges of rigged bids, extortion, and bribes. A $15 million state-of-the-art film studio that sits vacant. $90 million for a manufacturing facility whose construction may be shut down because of the corruption case. Give a fraction of that money to fund women's rights, and we will develop upstate economically. And we won't end up in jail. Let's start with sites, where it happened, where women's history happened. I'm on the governor's women's suffrage Centennial Commission, and I just came back from a meeting yesterday in Albany. I Love New York has a huge marketing budget to draw visitors from around the country and from Europe to the birthplace of women's rights right here in our area. But that's getting the cart before the horse. As Commission member Senator Betty Little said at the meeting, what if we bring all these visitors to the suffrage houses and they're in a state of disrepair? I ask further, what if the lights aren't on? Most of our houses and sites operate on half a shoestring. We need to begin with the physical infrastructure of the story. Make sure it's sound. Fill the sites with interactive, state-of-the-art exhibits and innovative programs that launch dialogues about the remaining issues of women's rights. I moved here in 1999 to save the house of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, which was suffering from deferred maintenance. We formed a nonprofit foundation, and in 10 years, we raised $1 million to purchase and restore Gage's home. We've now turned it into an award-winning museum, and we have two former board members here, I'm proud to say. We are taught in museum studies programs as an example of the new museum movement: innovative, relevant, crowdsourced, visitor-directed. Visitors make themselves at home at the Gage Center. They sit on the furniture. They write their ideas on the walls. They touch the artifacts. They play the piano and sing songs of freedom and justice that Matilda sang. They wander through the rooms, each telling the story of one of Matilda's social justice issues in this Center for Social Justice Dialogue. And they sit at Matilda's actual desk, which in most museums would be behind a barrier, inaccessible to the public. They sit at her desk and they leave her a note. A little aside, I own the desk. I will not give it up because it is my exercise in democracy. My idea is that people will so respect it that they won't harm it. That's been true for about 10 years. The desk is in pristine shape, and the desk is filled with notes. Very, very powerful and very tender and how to even begin it. One time I came downstairs, and a woman was sitting at the desk, and she was weeping. She was writing a note to Matilda. And I said, oh, are you okay? We self-guided tours. People make themselves at home. We make ourselves scarce. But she'd been down there about 2 hours, and she was going to come get me when she was ready to leave. I came down, and she's sitting there crying. And I thought, are you okay? What do you need? I was worried about her. She said, I'm fine. I just spent 2 hours reading every single thing on the walls here. And I sat down to write to Matilda, and I thought, how different my life would be if I had known about this woman. And she started to cry. Something powerful about democracy in action, huh? So, the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience calls the Gage Center a gutsy museum because we held the first dialogue on reproductive choice in any museum in the country. An example of abundance thinking is what Anne Ackerson named us when she was president of the Museum Association of New York. But what's our reality today? I'm going to be honest. We can only afford to be open 3 days a week. We need to upgrade our exhibits. We have no program budget, and we're not alone. The three leaders of the National Woman Suffrage Association, Gage, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Susan B. Anthony, have homes equidistant on the thruway. Gage in Fayetteville, an hour to Seneca Falls, to Stanton's home, and then an hour to Rochester, to Anthony's home. This is like they created this for heritage tourism. It couldn't be more perfect. But because of the Trump's administration hiring freeze, Women's Rights National Historic Park in Seneca Falls, where Stanton's house is now only open 3 days a week as well. We are the key to upstate development. Seneca Falls draws 20,000 visitors a year. With real marketing, we can draw these visitors to Fayetteville and Syracuse. And heritage tourism is the best bang for the buck, better than beer. Heritage tourists come, they stay longer, and they spend more. Give Gage 500,000 and we'd, what could we do with that? What would we do with real funding? We'd create 5 new jobs in 3 months. And then watch us grow, not just the Gage Center, but the upstate economy. Let me give you an example of how the Matilda effect works. We would love to apply for that $500,000 through the Central New York Regional Economic Development Council. But we don't have the staff to dedicate to that process. Them what don't have, don't get. We need your help. I got 2 glass 19th century containers up here. One of them has my card. I wish you would take it. The other is for your card to drop in and put a note on the back of what you're willing to do to help us. On a statewide level, let's look big. 2020, the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, is coming up fast. Our own Senator Gillibrand has introduced legislation, she actually announced it at the Gage Home, to establish a commission to plan it. Already the turf war has begun. Who will own the centennial of women's suffrage nationally? Who will take leadership? New Jersey can claim it. They held the first national women's rights convention, or Pennsylvania, the birthplace of democracy. But let's tell New York, we want to claim it. Not with War of 1812 funding, but with what women deserve funding. We are the real birthplace of democracy on the shores of Onondaga Lake, where the 5 Haudenosaunee nations before Columbus created the world's oldest continuing democracy in the world, the model for our own government. A story which is told brilliantly today at the Scano Great Law of Peace Center. We have the suffragists, and we have the women's rights activists in New York State, from the National Women's Suffrage Triumvirate, Anthony Stanton and Gage. We have the Civil War heroes, Mary Walker and Harriet Tubman. We have the first ordained women ministers, Antoinette Brown Blackwell, who was irregularly ordained, and Olympia Brown, whose ordination was recognized by her denomination, not surprisingly, the Unitarians. We have the richest landowner in the state of New York, Gerrit Smith, who used his wealth to fund every social justice cause in upstate New York, which was the hotbed of radical reform right here in central New York. And we have Victoria Woodhull, that communist stockbroker, fact check me, this is not fake news, ran for president, or announced her presidency in 1872. And Belva Lockwood, we have in New York State, the first woman lawyer to plead a case before the Supreme Court. And she also ran for president before women could vote. This is a moment when we can make history relevant. Women demanded equal pay for equal work as early as the 1850, when women made half the wages then that men made. 150 years later, and we've barely turned the corner on 75%. Do the math. At this rate, when will women have pay equity in the United States? Are you ready to wait another 150 years to get it? Healing can take place now as well. We can celebrate our victories and progress, but we also have an opportunity to practice truth and reconciliation. Strong connections existed between the anti-slavery and women's rights movements before the Civil War. The passage of the 14th Amendment, which defines citizenship as exclusively male, and the 15th Amendment, which gave African American men voting rights, split the two movements. the African-American struggle for an end to slavery and racial justice and the women's rights movement. The well-documented organizational racism of the National American Woman Suffrage Association after 1890 and later the Woman's Party, both of whom played the race card to win the right to vote, involved allowing their state organizations to segregate, making African American women march at the end of their parades, and asking allies like Frederick Douglass not to attend conventions in the South. Acknowledging this legacy of racism can begin healing this long festering wound. It's time. The movement we're commemorating was messy, but it was also militant. It was illegal for women to vote, and these suffragists broke the law by voting or attempting to in droves. It was not just Susan B. Anthony. Matilda Joslyn Gage attempted to vote in Fayetteville the year before Anthony voted and was arrested. Hers was the test case. But 4 years before she voted, women were already attempting to vote. It was a massive campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience. That's the story of woman suffrage. They impeached the government for its treatment of women in 1876. Knowing they might be arrested, they said they had more cause for revolution than the founding fathers, and they risked arrest when they illegally presented their Declaration of Rights of Women at the official centennial celebration. They chained themselves to the White House and called out President Wilson for fighting for democracy across the ocean while denying it to women at home. We honor these women lightly by voting, but we honor them deeply by picking up the issues they began, demanding full equality and self-determination in every part of our collective lives. They worked to get constitutional protection for the vote for 72 years. We picked up their issue and have worked for equal rights to be guaranteed to women in the Constitution, the ERA, for guess how many years? 93 years, and we still don't have an Equal Rights Amendment. And to add insult to injury, the U.S. is the only democracy that has not ratified CEDAW, the International Bill of Rights for Women. Will we enter 2020 an embarrassment in the eyes of the world because the U.S. arrogantly demands human rights from every country, while refusing to recognize equal rights for women in our own country? Now, I'm going to speak to the women. We would never have achieved what we did without the support of male allies. If we can't have the vote, how are we going to be able to get the vote unless men vote to give us the vote? Male allies have been absolutely essential. But you allies get a chance to sit and listen while I speak to the women. When New York suffragists demanded and won the right to vote in school elections in 1880, Governor Lucius Robinson vetoed the bill, declaring that the God of nature did not intend women for public life. When he ran again for governor, the women resolved that the same power should retire Mr. Robinson from public life. They defeated him, and the next governor promptly signed the bill. Matilda Joslyn Gage, who led the fight, left us this message in 1880. When men begin to fear the power of women, their voice and their influence, Then we shall secure justice, but not before. When we demonstrate our ability to kill off or seriously injure a candidate or hurt a party, then we shall receive respectful consideration. We must be recognized as aggressive. We are far too well behaved. It's true, well behaved women seldom make history. Let's stop being nice girls. Nice girls don't make history. Let's be like our foremothers, the mass of angry, militant feminists that make men once again fear the power of women. Let's stop being well-behaved women. Let's kick us some ass and make us some history. Thank you. So,
thanks for your presentation. I was real interested in the way you described the suffrage movement as not always progressive and not always on the forefront of advancing everyone's rights, and the way it kind of cut across the ply when you talk about temperance and white supremacy and so on. And by the way, I'm a proud feminist and ally, and I'd just like to say my grandmother, Jeanette Stevenson Murray, there may have been vote for school board in Iowa, but she was president of the school board in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, before the suffrage amendment was passed, I believe.
Thank you. Piece of history.
My question is about the rules that are now being promulgated to restrict the vote or make it more harder to vote or require more ID to vote. And it's said that that could result in suppression of the vote, particularly for African Americans. Mm-hmm. And people with less resources. And I just wondered if you could speak for a minute about how that might apply to women.
Yeah. I think, you know, this is a case where intersectionality is really the issue we're talking about. You know, there's a connection that we're seeing in the response to the threat to human rights today in our country. And that is, a connection of all of the movements working together. And so I think that with the issue of voter suppression, the anniversary of women's suffrage presents a vehicle through which we can examine that. It seems to me that's one of the major issues we should be talking about. How does this affect women, especially women of color, especially women with an absence of means? You know, how does this affect disproportionately the groups of people that are most oppressed? And I think that's the power of this moment that we're facing historically. You know, women's history is on the back burner most of the time, like all history is. But when you have an anniversary like this, it comes to the front burner. And that allows you not just to look backward, but to look forward. The Lieutenant Governor yesterday in the commission meeting really talked about that what we need to do with 2017 is not just look at celebrating what happened, but what are the issues that remain undone. If we don't know the history of women's suffrage, that all these issues that we're dealing with today are ones that were already raised 150 years ago. If we don't know that, we don't know that we're continuing a struggle. So I think that the long answer is we do need to look at that. And I think that this is a time that we can really do that. With funding.
Thank you very much. It was a wonderful presentation. I have two quick questions, I guess. One, the 3 days a week that the museum is open. Question number one. And what was it about Gage that made her even less well-known than Anthony and Stanton?
Yeah, the 3 days are Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 10 to 2. 10 to 3 usually, but 10 to 2 safely. And what we're doing right now is training facilitators. We used to call them docents. Now they're facilitators. They facilitate a conversation with the visitors. So, again, there's a little glass thing up there if anyone would like to be trained in this very simple method. And it's really what we want to do is just invite people to come in and experience the museum, because everything is interactive on their own. And so facilitators are, you know, just the process of, you know, getting a dialogue started with visitors. So we're training facilitators now, and we're hoping to be open another day, Saturday, and then the big dream is a weekend night. But that's going to be done completely by volunteers. We have no budget for that. The second question, that's the long one. How do we not know about Matilda? She actually was unfortunately written out of history as the movement became more and more conservative. She opposed the merger between the American, which was the progressive, I'm sorry, the National was the progressive wing of the women's rights movement. The American was the more conservative. And Susan B. Anthony saw the vote as an end in itself. It was like, let's all come together, whatever our issues are and differences are, and in a united front, work just for the vote. Put all the other issues on the table until we get the vote, and then we'll take care of those issues. Well, that merger, which Gage opposed, brought in, and Susan B. Anthony engineered, brought in the Women's Christian Temperance Union, an organized army of mother love for God, home, and heaven. And their platform was not just to end the use of alcohol and tobacco in the country. It was also to end the freedom of religion in the country. They wanted prayer in the public schools, God in the Constitution, and Jesus Christ as the head of the government. Well, what were the implications of that? If you were not Christian, and probably fundamental Christian, you would not be able to vote. You would not be able to run for public office. It would create a theocracy that Gage said was the greatest danger of the hour. If we lose religious freedom, it's not going to matter who votes, was her position. So she opposed the merger. It went through. Susan B. Anthony really pushed this through, along with her ring of girls, they were called. And the result was a growing conservatism in the movement. Gage wrote about the position of Haudenosaunee women. She said, never was justice more perfect, never was civilization higher than the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. You know, she speaks in this glowing way of indigenous people and an indigenous way of understanding the world. If you're playing the race card, that's not going to look very good. She was an abolitionist. She said there will be no permanent peace until there is absolute equality. It wasn't just to end slavery, but the work then was to create absolute equality. If you're playing the race card, that is not looking good. And because the attempt was to really, bring everybody together, and that meant Christian conservatives and the South, that was the strategy of the National American, Gage didn't fit into that at all. She dropped out of the movement, and she was beyond that, an embarrassment.
So
this is one of the supporters of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Foundation. It's wonderful to see you. Thank you for coming.
You're welcome. So this the Gage Foundation is really cool. I remember when we went with our Girl Scout troop, and we got to try on all the costumes and see how it was different from the what the indigenous people wore and from what the Europeans wore, because it was so hard to walk in the heels and everything with what the Europeans wore to then compared to what the indigenous people wore. And I also thought it was cool at the Gage Foundation where you could act out the scenes of what happened, like when, what's his name? The Wizard of Oz guy, I forget his name.
Frank Oz. Alfred Baum.
Him, when he proposed to Matilda's daughter, that was one of the best scenes that we got to act out. That was cool.
I swear I did not pay her. Thank you. That was a wonderful testimony. That's what the Gage Foundation is. You try on the clothes, you act things out, you, yes. Thank you. Wow.
Hello, thank you so much for an inspiring presentation. I'm going to make sure my daughters listen to the broadcast later. I wonder, in your opinion, people like Phyllis Schlafly, who worked hard against the ERA, is that more powerful when women work against it, in your opinion? And is that why you think she was successful, because she was a woman?
Phyllis Schlafly? She was successful because she had the backing of, she had great financial backing. She was a right-wing operative before she opposed the ERA. The ERA was heavily opposed by the insurance industry initially because it would have cost a lot of money to create equality. You know, if you think about, if women are making, white women, or women generally, are making 77 cents for the dollar that a man makes, who's getting the other 25 cents, 23 cents, huh? It's good for business to have pay inequity. It's not good for families to have pay inequity. So I think Phyllis Schlafly is a case where she was really a hired operative, and we were pretty aware of that at the time. The thing that's just outrageous is that 93 years later, since the introduction of the ERA, we still do not have equal rights guaranteed in the United States of America. And I think, you know, the women of the 19th century movement kept referring to what we would be thinking today, and they were leaving a legacy for us. And I think the question for us is, what are we leaving for women 150 years from now?
I was very interested to hear about the what resources did you look through in the Historical Society for your research on the Haudenosaunee? What are the written records, and what are there some resources you could recommend that we could read that would? I'm very curious of the history and learning further.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really pay these people or set them up. I mean, just, well, I love to speak to the. To sing out, to give a shout out to the OHA Iroquois Collection. Mrs. Wright, when this was when all the newspapers, as I understand it, and you could help me with this, but I think when all the newspapers were being microfilmed, they were then destroyed. And she went through those newspapers and cut out all of the important stories of all kinds of different issues. And the Iroquois Collection at the OHA is one of the best collections of it's not just contemporary. It goes from the time of the printing of the Post Standard, I think, in the 40s to the 50s. Is it 1950s, or When did she stop, or is it continued to be? Could you speak to that?
I'm Dennis Connors, the curator of history at the OHA, and we still have all the bound newspapers. They take up half a floor, probably 5,000 square feet, because the newspapers and the libraries, once it was all microfilm, they didn't want the original hardbound copies. In a lot of cases, we had duplicate sets. Two sets of the Herald journals from, you know, 1880s or whatever. And Carolyn Wright meticulously would go through as a volunteer and page after page of the duplicates and clip out different articles about all sorts of subjects, the Iroquois, women's rights, different individuals, and neatly put them into file folders. So that when you're looking for a particular subject, you can just go to that file folder and read actual articles written from the 1840s, the 1850s, the 1860s. It's very interesting now because a lot of the microfilm has deteriorated. And even on the online archives of the Post Standard where they've digitized the microfilm, a lot of it is unreadable. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that OHA still has the original newspapers, I do it all the time when I'm doing research there. I'll go online, I'll find an article on the website, the Post Standard Archives website, and I literally can't read the article because the quality is so bad. I just go up to the third floor and find the original bound edition, flip to that page, and it's in perfect condition. So that's getting a little bit off the topic. But yes, Carolyn Wright and other volunteers have been able to create a massive set of vertical files that contains all sorts of really valuable information, including about the Haudenosaunee. I should also point out, if you're not so inclined to go digging through newspaper articles or going down to the OHA Visitor Center, as was mentioned, the Scano Center, the former Visitor Center at St. Marie on the Iroquois, is the story of the Haudenosaunee told by them. And there's a lot of the women's role that's explained out there as well. That is the former Visitor Center for St. Marie on the Iroquois out on Onondaga Lake Parkway.
As we have two of the best kept secrets, I think, in Onondaga County are the extraordinary Scano Center. It is state of the art. It is, if I dare say, the premier museum in this region, and the Gage Center, the humble little Gage Center. But I think that we're both, we need more visibility. But thank you, Dennis. I'll tell you one story from that collection. I was going through some of the articles with a friend of mine from the Onondaga Nation, and she found a photograph of her grandfather, and they'd had a fire in the house, and this was the only photograph of the grandfather that they had, and it was housed in the OHA. So it's an incredible resource.
Thank you so much, Sally, for joining us this morning. Please join me.